Welcome back to Hash Rate Up. Today is all about TerraWolf. I had the great pleasure of sitting down with Nazar Khan, VP and co-founder of TerraWolf Inc., another NASDAQ-listed miner in the USA, to talk about energy markets, sustainability, where he thinks Bitcoin mining is going. We delved into the AI topic a little bit in the end that they're now exploring. It was a great conversation, very easy job on my side this end. Nazar is fantastic, very knowledgeable, and I'm sure there are even tidbits for those of you who have listened to him speak before. Hash Rate Up starts now. Enjoy. All right. So like I said in the brief introduction, I am back today with Nazar Khan. We have a hash price of 57. We are at a 14-day hash rate at 604 exahashes. Our block height is 845912. Nazar is VP, COO, CTO, co-founder of TerraWolf. I just asked him in the pre-interview what he wasn't. Nazar, what are you not at TerraWolf? Hi, welcome.
Thank you, Jesse. It's wonderful to be here. I am not a lot of things. You know, we have a wonderful team at TerraWolf. I think, you know, we've got one of the best operation teams, and we have one of the best CFOs. Our strategy office is amazing. So I'm not a lot of things. But also, when you start your own business, you end up doing a lot of different things as well. And so I like to tell people I have no real tangible skills that I have, but I try to get done what I can. And so you plug holes and build things along. So it's, I think, the fun of being an entrepreneur as well, is just being able to kind of, you know, show up and do things where it's needed, despite what, you know, a title or role may indicate.
Yeah, I'm feeling the same pains, you know, doing everything by myself as a sole entrepreneur. And there's a bunch of ideas where I think, maybe I could pay somebody else to do X or Y. Nazar, a lot of people that listen to this might be new to the Bitcoin mining industry, even though they understand Bitcoin. While they understand the fundamentals, they don't know who the figures are. Can you, and I know if you've done a few of these, can you briefly tell people a bit about your background, how you came into Bitcoin? Say maybe for TerraWolf, where you got started, and highlight maybe who the first person was that was actually hired.
Sure. So our background's in power generation. So for 20 plus years, we had a company called Beowulf Energy, which was founded by Paul Prager, who's TerraWolf's chairman and CEO. I met Paul in the late 90s, and we started working together in 2000. And so for 20 plus years, we developed, constructed, designed, and operated and owned power generation facilities, both thermal and renewable, both domestically in the United States and in overseas jurisdictions as well. And we were a developer, and so by nature, and so we were looking for places to put power onto the grid. And so whether that, again, that was building a new plant, repositioning an existing asset, or growing an asset, you know, our job really was, you know, where is power needed and what type of power can we put onto the grid? And effectively, you know, we sold wholesale electricity. And so we want to produce at X and make, you know, sell it for X plus something. And in able to do that, you really have to have a, you know, nuanced understanding of regulation. You know, power at the end of the day is a very regulated industry. Understand kind of how the network or the system in the various jurisdictions you're working in works and comes together. Where are the transmission lines? Where there's supply? Where there's demand? Are there any bottlenecks that exist? And so that's what we did. And so I led the development acquisition group, and, you know, was really focused in thinking about, again, where do we buy assets? Where do we develop assets? Where do we reposition assets? And in that business, you know, fundamentally, a power generator is a converter. You're taking, you know, a fuel source, and whether that's a BTU of coal or gas or the wind and the sun, running it through a generator and a turbine and generating a kilowatt hour of power. And the inputs into that are, what is your CapEx? You know, what does it cost you to build this operation that you have. What is your variable cost for fuel? You know, for a thermal asset, there's some variable cost. For renewable assets, there's no real variable cost. You run it through your machine, and on the back end, you have a kilowatt hour power. And so, you know, there's a spread that you make per unit that you're making, and then there's a front end CapEx, and you think about, okay, hey, how do I, you know, amortize this over time, and how do I think about the returns associated with it? And how do you finance it? Is it equity? Is it debt? And in the power space, traditionally, you would have, you know, a decent amount of leverage embedded in there because these were, you know, long-term assets and people are always buying power. That was our business. And what's been happening, you know, I would say over the last, you know, 10 years, you know, we're seeing it in the United States, and we're also seeing it in a number of overseas jurisdictions, is there's been a concerted effort to decarbonize the supply stack, which means, you know, let's, you know, ramp down those thermal assets. You know, that's really started with coal. That's kind of gotten into gas and bring in, you know, zero carbon generation. And that's predominantly been fed by wind and solar assets. So fundamentally, there was a transition happening on the supply stack, which made our business different. You know, again, we were a wholesale generator. We'd produce it at X, try to sell it for X plus something. And given this transition that was occurring, you know, I started to see that the business of selling wholesale electricity was challenged. And the other important factor to think about is, you know, from 2015 till, you know, I'd say the last year or so, demand, in particularly in the United States, was flat. You know, so there was no demand growth. You know, so the overall demand was flat. You had older assets coming on, and you had a significant number of new kind of intermittent resources being added on. And so our original business of selling wholesale electricity, you know, started to change. And I started looking around and saying, hey, how do I take the skill sets that I have? Again, I've been doing this for 20 years, and I'm not going to figure out something that I'm really good at, you know, quickly. And so how do I, you know, what do we do? And I realized that if I had a load to manage against, I could better optimize the value of a kilowatt hour of power. And you know, the thing that people, I think, misunderstand about how power works is fundamentally there's a significant amount of fixed cost in the system. When you build a transmission line, it's all fixed cost. And whether you use it an hour a day or 24 hours a day, it's the same thing. It costs the same thing to build it. It costs the same thing to maintain it. On the generation side, again, all of the vast majority of the assets we're adding are all fixed costs, right? You put up a wind plant or a solar plant, it's all fixed costs. There's very little. There's some marginal cost, but it's very little marginal cost. It's all fixed cost. And in a system that's largely fixed cost based, the overall system utilization is, you know, I think the most important variable that people miss. And that just means how much you're using it. Are you using it 50% of the time, 90% of the time, 35% of the time? And the delta between using it 40%, 80% is on a per unit basis, 2x. And so I said, hey, if we have a load to manage against, we can increase overall system utilization and kind of better, you know, optimize a kilowatt hour of electricity. And so this is 2018. I started looking at different loads. I said, you know, maybe data centers would work. That's its own kind of business. And then, you know, I quickly tumbled into Bitcoin. And so when I understood what Bitcoin was, you know, I became pretty enamored with it and said, hey, this is something I should be looking at. Started buying Bitcoin and started spending more time thinking about, you know, how Bitcoin mining worked, because everyone said, hey, the number one input to mine Bitcoin is power. I said, hey, I know a thing or two about power. Let me see how this all comes together. And as I studied it, I realized that fundamentally Bitcoin mining was just energy infrastructure. And again, you were just a converter. You're taking a kilowatt hour of power, you're putting up a building or a container, you put an ASIC in it, you run that power through an ASIC, and you're generating hash. And so you have a front end CapEx, you got to put up your infrastructure, you got to buy a miner, you have your input cost, which is your cost of power. And on the back end, you have hash. And in any 10 minute period, you know all those variables. And so you started this show by saying, you know, where the block height was, where the hash price was. So again, in any 10 minute increment, you have all of the details. And, you know, right now, you know, every 10 minutes, you know, of the day that goes by, I can tell you where we are, you know, in terms of our business and kind of making money. And so when I understood how Bitcoin mining worked, it was fairly obvious to me that this was, you know, an extremely important load as a part of the grid. And we could do a lot with it. And so that's in 2018, 2019, we really started our journey of saying, hey, you know, we should be taking our power and mining Bitcoin, both because Bitcoin is this amazing asset. But in addition to that, a Bitcoin mining load can actually be very beneficial to the grid and really could be an effective way to monetize a kilowatt hour of power.
I would say, judging from what you just said, that, you know, typically folks that come from the traditional energy background have a very hard time grasping Bitcoin and Bitcoin as a load and as a flexible load, and isn't it all for criminals and yada, yada, yada. You've heard this before, right? What do you think made you accept it as a potential solution? And even if you explore data centers as a load, right, the finding Bitcoin is not often a natural transition. I know that's changed today, but back when you started, certainly I would feel like it wasn't. What do you think made that happen? What made you look at Bitcoin more closely?
Sure. We were one of the early players in the power space to really get into Bitcoin. And at the time, a number of people thought that we were making a risky move. And what I would tell people is it's actually not that risky when you understand just how the economics of Bitcoin work. And again, as a miner, you know, there's obviously some, there is, price has matters, you know. And if, you know, for example, for today, if the price of Bitcoin runs to 100,000, that's going to generate a higher hash price. And if it drops to 20,000, that'll generate a lower hash price. But all of that being said, to the extent that you have an efficient fleet of machines and you have a low cost of power, you're going to be making money. And whether that is X or 2X or 4X, again, depends upon these variables. But fundamentally, my view was that given our background in power, and if we, again, had an efficient fleet of miners, we would always be making money. And again, whether that payback ended up being less than 2 years or 4 years or 5 years, you know, it could kind of bounce around. But fundamentally, that was meaningfully better than a 15 or 20 year payback, is, you know, which is what a traditional power asset kind of amortizes over. Right? So when you're building a power plant, you know, very rarely would we go into building a power plant and say we're going to get our money back in 3 or 4 years. And that's almost unheard of. You know, we would, you know, be looking at a 15 or 20 year period. And when you think about modeling out where the price of power is going to be over 2 years, let alone 20 years, it's a, you know, inexact science at best. And then if you factor in, you have a resource that needs kind of an input fuel, let's just take natural gas, for example. Now you have to think about the interplay of the price of power in a market plus the price of gas. You know, I would argue that that's a far riskier analysis that you're making, given that you're trying to do that over 10, 15, 20 years, than thinking about the interplay between kind of the price of an ASIC and the hash and the price of Bitcoin. And the reason being that fundamentally, your payback periods that you're talking about, again, in good times, we talk about payback periods of, you know, 2 years or less. And then, you know, when things are not right, I mean, at a $50, $60 hash price, we're still talking about payback periods, you know, somewhere in 3 to 4 years. So fundamentally, you know, as I thought about it, there was a meaningful benefit in kind of how Bitcoin worked. And it was far riskier, I thought, than thinking about, you know, spending a dollar and investing into kind of putting up a new power generation asset. And so that's where I think people didn't appreciate the underlying kind of system and how it worked. And again, they thought that, you know, hey, we're putting power, you know, we're building an asset that's going to be around forever. But again, trying to make your money back over 15, 20 years. I mean, just think about where the world was 20 years ago and where we think the world's going to be 20 years from today. And, you know, I would say that I'm far more comfortable thinking about, you know, how do I get my money back in 2 years than I am in a much longer period of time.
Yeah, fair enough. Especially also because this special load is not only online all the time whenever you want it, but it also is not influenced by geopolitics or the revenue certainty isn't, right? There's always hash being produced and there's a block every 10 minutes, no matter what happens. At that point, was there reputational risk? Forget about the economic risks. What was the reputational risk among your peers?
We're developers, right? So our background is to, you know, chart new areas, go to new places and build new things. And so as developers, we're always, you know, we think of ourselves as creating new opportunities. And so again, versus a traditional utility, you know, they may have a different mindset. You know, for us, getting into Bitcoin, you know, I didn't really, again, see it as a reputational risk. And again, there's a lot of, you know, noise about how it gets used. And I mean, again, when you really break it down, it's the most public asset out there. And if you really wanted to do something, you know, nefarious at scale, you know, in a large way, you know, Bitcoin's probably not a good way to do it anyways. And so the more you know about it, you know, you just kind of, you know, again, there's a lot of noise out there. So I didn't see that. That wasn't a concern of ours in any way. And you noted the flexibility of the resource. And the other thing, if you think about it, you know, I mentioned earlier that the grid is transitioning, right? The supply stack is transitioning. And so what's happened is that you're fundamentally flipping on the head the way that the grid operates. You know, 25 years ago, we had, you know, mostly dispatchable generation resources, coal plants, gas plants that you could kind of move up and down. You know, on any given day, right, the peak to trough on the daily demand is, you know, almost 2x, you know, what where the power demand is at 2 a.m. is probably, you know, half of what it is at, you know, 2 p.m, 3 p.m. So there is a shape, you know, on a daily basis. And then there's also a seasonal shape, right, depending upon where you're on the world. You know, the winter is different from the summer, is different from the spring and the fall. And so all of the resources that are being added to the grid now are not dispatchable. They're there when they're there. They're there when the wind blows and when the sun shines. And so now how is the grid going to be balanced? And fundamentally, I think it's going to be balanced by dispatchable load. So, you know, I've said we flipped, you know, kind of the structure on its head. We've gone from a system that had significant dispatchable generation. And now we're replacing that all with, you know, again, intermittent non-dispatchable generation. And so fundamentally, the way I see it is that the loads are going to have to be far more responsive. And I think, you know, everybody walks around with, you know, mini supercomputers in their pockets today. You know, everything's kind of connected to high tech. You know, everyone's talking about AI. And so 10 years from today, you know, I forecast that every load is going to be far more flexible and responsive than it is today. Some loads will be more responsive, some loads will be less responsive, but fundamentally every single load is going to be far more flexible and responsive than it is today. And Bitcoin mining is the most economically sensitive, you know, load that there is. And again, we just talked about any 10-minute period, we know exactly what we're doing, we know exactly what the economics are associated with that. So the other piece that really caught my attention was in this world where, again, we're flipping the structure on its head, the value of dispatchable load is going to be extremely important. And, you know, I tell folks that good Bitcoin miners, 3-4 years from today, 30% plus of the revenue will come from not mining Bitcoin. It will come from selling value back to the grid and the services they can provide. So they're going to make money mining Bitcoin for sure. Bitcoin's a wonderful asset, but the ones that are going to have the lowest cost and are going to be the best positioned at scale are going to be the ones that understand how to position these loads back into the grid and can sell those resources back to the grid. So that's the second theme. You know, when I tell people what's so fascinating or good about TerraWulf, I said, hey, Bitcoin's a great asset. We're a low cost producer. But second, you are playing, you know, the transition of the energy grid. And again, we're transitioning from a supply stack that's dispatchable to that supply stack that's becoming less dispatchable. And we are a dispatchable load, and we are the most flexible dispatchable load that exists, you know, out there today. And so our team spends a ton of time thinking about how do we ensure that our load is as responsive to the grid as possible. And so we spend time with the grid operators, with the local utilities, in ensuring that every single, you know, electron of flexibility that we have, you know, we're making sure that they're aware of it. And in some sense, we're also pushing the envelope on what they can do. And, you know, for example, you know, in the power space, a signal to ramp down a power plant is usually a 15-minute signal. So the grid operator says, hey, gas plant, we need you to come down, you know, 50 megawatts or 100 megawatts. You know, we're telling you, but you got to get there in 15 minutes. And then the power plant kind of does its thing. In the Bitcoin mining space, if we needed to drop 100 megawatts, we could do that in 15 seconds. And that flexibility, the value of that is nonlinear, meaning, you know, if you're able to do it really in 15 seconds or 30 seconds, the value to the grid operator is immensely more than it is in someone being able to do it in 15 minutes. And so that's where, even today, I don't think the grid fully appreciates and understands how valuable that responsiveness is. And so over time, I also think that, you know, the responsiveness that we're bidding in is, you know, undervalued in the way that the grid operates. But again, you know, even with that, it's going to be a meaningful and important component of the revenue that we make at TerraWolf.
Okay, I will struggle to get this question out properly, so bear with me, okay? It's almost like now, before Bitcoin mining, with the unramping of additional inflexible generation, such as wind and solar, we always have an overhang of supply, right? In most cases, we have an overhang of supply, and that delta has to be financed either through subsidies or through power prices. This is why we see power prices of 40 cents in Germany, for instance, right? The world where we want to be is actually an overhang of demand. So we always want to have more demand than we have power generation. And we want a portion of that demand to be able to be curtailed, which is why the both of us talk about Bitcoin mining all day and try to make money in this industry, right? Because it's very interesting and curious. But the question I have for you, Nizar, is how do we avoid, and I know we want to talk a bit about infrastructure. You said the utilization factor of infrastructure matters, right? A transmission line costs what it costs, and how much you use it depends on yourself, and that determines the payback period. How do we make sure that the payback period for infrastructure for flexible load remains short? And how do we make sure that that infrastructure doesn't flip the table? You know, I feel like there's a chance that in the future we'll have so much infrastructure to pay back for flexible loads that we will have a pressure on an upwards pressure on power prices again. How do we make sure that's not the case? Does that make sense?
Sure. I'll try to, there's a few things that you had in there. So we are now entering into a period where demand growth is showing back up again. So in the United States, if you pick up any utilities forecast for the next 5 or 10 years, their forecasts for demand growth are 3 times, 4 times what they thought they were two, 3 years ago. And a lot of that is being, or not, I'd say half of that roughly, is being driven by AI data center demand, right? So a lot of the data center operators are coming and saying, we want more and more power. And so half of it's kind of being driven by that. And then I'd say the other half is just overall electrification of economies, whether it's electric vehicles, you know, electrification of heating and cooling, pumps. I mean, so there's just an overall kind of theme of electrification of a number of different things in the system as well. So you put those together and all of a sudden now we're going from a period where, again, we had relatively flat demand growth for 6, 7, 8 years to now all of a sudden where you have demand growth. And so you said earlier in the question, you know, we want to be in a place where we have more demand than we have supply. And I would say not quite. And again, when you think about how the system works, right, there's 8,760 hours in a year. And usually there's probably 200 to 300 hours a year where the system is stressed, right? Because the system is designed to meet peak demand plus some margin. And at 2 a.m. on any given day, you're probably not going to be anywhere close to peak demand. 3 a.m. on any given day, you're probably not going to be close to peak demand. So when you think about the number of hours in the year that the grid is actually solving for, it's in the context of 8,760 hours in the year, it's actually a very small period. And so the real, you know, the way I see it is the real question is it's in those 300, 400 hours. And again, depending upon where you are and what the season is, you know, it could be less, it could be more, but I mean, directionally, it's kind of that size. It's in those 300 to 400 hours. How does the system work? Do we have enough supply to kind of meet, you know, what's happening? And the vast majority, that means the vast majority of the hours of the year, generally, there's more supply than there is demand. And so flexible loads at Bitcoin, therefore, if Bitcoin, a miner can run 95% of the time and get a low cost of power, that's a fabulous business. If they can run 97% of the time and get a really low cost of power, that's a fabulous business. That's what we target to do. So to me, it's less, again, about, you know, creating more demand than there is supply. It's really understanding what that peak demand looks like and what are the resources that can either not be there during those hours, just, you know, just kind of curtail and not be there, or what are the resources where we can shift that demand to other parts of the day or other parts, you know, or do 2 days later or 2 days, you know, before. depending upon, you know, what's happening. So that's where, again, these flexible loads become important. And, you know, the example I like to use is that, you know, a couple of years ago in the state of California, there was a potential for rolling brownouts. You know, demand was getting to kind of peak levels and people were concerned that, you know, they're going to have to, you know, curtail residential customers, you know, retail, in industrial, office. And what happened? You know, the governor of California sent out a tweet and saying, hey, you know, power demand is going to be really high. Please do what you can to conserve your use of electricity. And what happened? Literally, there was a decrease in demand by almost 7%. There was a 7% decrease in demand because you had millions of individuals saying, okay, hey, I'm not going to run the dryer now. I'm not going to, you know, run the microwave. You know, I'm going to, you know, not going to charge my car, whatever it was. But you had millions of people now consciously thinking about how much power they're consuming. And those individual decisions aggregated into a meaningful number. Is that a sustainable solution that the governor can tweet? After the second time or third time he tweets, no one's going to, you know, actually respond to it. You know, he did it once, and so there was kind of response to it. So it was interesting in that it showed that the aggregation of millions of individual decisions can have a meaningful impact on peak demand. The problem is how do you do that reliably and sustainably, and how do you repeat it? And that's, I think, a fundamental question that we have. But again, when you think about Bitcoin mining loads, because it can be a meaningful load, and because someone can send us a signal, you know, today we're running 210 megawatts, we'll be running 250 megawatts here within the next month, we can curtail 250 megawatts pretty quickly. And so that's, again, where I just think that understanding where power is kind of coming from, where power is being used, understanding what those large consumers of power are, and how do we make sure that those large consumers have a level of responsiveness associated with them? Because again, the economic signals that we can send to them are going to be far more efficient and clear. But over time, and again, over time, I do believe if you play it out over 10 or 15 years, AI, technology, we have all these things. I really do believe that the aggregation of those millions of individual decisions will also kind of, you know, roll into where we end up on peak demand. So where I see it is that, you know, we as Bitcoin miners should never be adding a single kilowatt hour to peak demand. We should never add a single kilowatt hour to peak demand. And if we're doing that, then we are always going to be a resource back to the grid. But if we are adding to peak demand, we're going to be a burden. And then legitimately, people can say, hey, you're driving up the cost of power. You're requiring us to build more generation or more transmission lines. And that theme I see playing out, you know, in the AI data center space as we speak, because they come into the market saying, hey, we want to run 24/7 no matter what. And the larger companies, the Microsoft, the Amazons, the Googles of the world, they're flush with cash. And so they don't really care how much it costs. They say, we don't care. Just tell us how much it costs to run 24/7. We'll pay it. And the challenge I think they're going to have is that it's going to become no longer an economic question. It's going to become a reliability question. The grid operator in Northern Virginia has already said, hey, data centers, we can't give you more power. If you want to run 24/7, we have nothing to give you. You have to hold up. You have to wait a couple of years and let us build more stuff. And rightfully, the ratepayers in that territory are saying, hey, Dominion, if you're going to build more power generation and more transmission to feed that load, and then you're going to amortize that cost over all of the ratepayers, we're paying more. Why? I mean, if Microsoft needs 500 megawatts, let them pay for everything. Why am I having to pay more because Microsoft needs 500 megawatts of power? So you are already seeing, you know, in the data center and AI space, this theme that when you're adding to peak demand, you do have consequences for the rest of the ratepayers in that system. And rightfully so, they should say, hey, you know, we what benefit are we getting from this extra burden?
I would back up for one step. I've said this previously, sure, on the show before, and this is my thesis or my statement, I guess. In no other market is a free market as important as in the power space, because there's always a need for equilibrium between demand and supply, right? Electrons work the same way no matter where you are. It's just regulation that's different. I would slightly disagree with you in that Bitcoin miners should never use peak demand, because if they pay for it, they should be free to use it, right? If hash price goes through the roof, you're going to see 100% uptime all over the place. And even in summertime, people, if the price of the hash is high enough, if it makes sense to mine, it makes sense to mine, right? The key is that it usually doesn't, and miners cannot afford it. They might be, you know, obliged to curtail, and that's a different story. But what you're saying perfectly leads sort of into my next question.
But if, sorry to interrupt you, Jesse, yeah, but just on that point, the challenge with that is that, again, in a 10-minute increment or 1-hour increment, the price of power is 4 cents. I'm just making numbers up. Mm-hmm. And let's just say, you know, based upon where the price of Bitcoin is and the network hash rate is, it's profitable to mine. So you mine. And what happens? And peak demand is not X, it's X plus something. When, what happens though, right? So in that hour or 10-minute increment, you're saying, hey, it's all economics, it's a free market, people should do what they need to do. I understand that approach. However, the problem that happens is then the utility or the grid operator, the entity that's responsible for reliability on the grid says, hey, we just hit peak demand here. And now we have all these other things kind of happening, and we're going to have load growth, and therefore now we need to build more transmission, we need to build more distribution, we need to build more generation. They don't, and them, again, we have trouble forecasting where the price of Bitcoin and where the network hash rate is going to be 6 months later, a year later, 3 years later. So now the utility has not just Bitcoin mining, they have 47 other loads that they have to kind of think about. And so when you start to see peak demand increasing, the natural response that you're going to see from a entity that's responsible for reliability of the grid is to say, okay, hey, this is where peak demand is. And if, again, we have all these other things happening, it's going to continue to grow, their reaction is going to be to build more stuff. And while in that 10-minute increment, you may have been economic, in the long run, you may be a reason why they're having to build more stuff, which is therefore going to increase the cost of power next year, the year after that, or year after that.
Why?
If you understand what I'm saying.
Why does it increase the cost of power if there's more supply?
Because they're going to have to build more stuff. And when you start to build more stuff, you know, you have to kind of finance that. The ratepayers have to pay for it. And if, again, that peak load that you hit, you know, you did it because Bitcoin was 120,000 and it worked. And 3 years later, when that generation actually comes online and Bitcoin is 80,000, but the network hash rate has doubled and it's no longer economic, those hundreds of megawatts that showed up on peak demand in, you know, the prior periods won't be there in the next period. And so now, because system utilization is important, and those 300 or 400 or 500 or a gigawatt didn't show up, the per unit cost for everyone else is going up. So that's where I just think the challenge in infrastructure, right, is that the signals and the response take so long, right? It takes a long time to build infrastructure. It takes a long time to build transmission. And so the signals that you see here and today that feed into long-term decisions. And then if there's a mismatch in kind of what the inputs you used versus what actually happens on the ground. And that happens all the time. In infrastructure, you have boom and bust cycles because the information that people use to make decisions today end up being very different than the actual reality, you know, when that infrastructure comes online 2, 3, 4 years later. And so you have these periods of overbuilding and then underbuilding, right? So because the signals, there's a mismatch. So that's why our approach as TerraWulf is, I don't really care what the marginal value of that hash is. If we're hitting peak demand, we're not running, because I know that if we're running in peak demand because economically in that moment it makes sense, the signal that was sending to the overall market and the reaction from the market will be to build more stuff, which will cost more money, which over time will drive up my cost of power.
But then if you take that one step further, that's your individual company decision, right? That you, right, as a free market player are making, because now you're thinking long term. Right, you could think short term and say, "Hey, mine," because it's worth it. But long term, you're thinking that might not be such a good idea, and our economics suffer. And at the end of the day, that's also an economic decision, right?
Sure.
There's always this lag and this boom and bust, as you said. My sort of consequence or immediate consequence without thinking about it much would be, hey, you know, if there's more supply mid long term, it means that there's cheaper access to power, which means more Bitcoin mining and then also more curtailment. And at the end of the day, with more generation and more flexible loads present, power prices go down for everybody.
Depends, right? And so that's what's happened, right? So if you think about the last 5 or 7 years, what you just went through is what's happened, right? There was renewable generation being added at scale. There wasn't enough demand to suck it up. Bitcoin miners said, hey, we can do that. We can fill those periods, negative priced hours, low priced hours, off peak hours. Hey, we're here. And yeah, when the prices are high, you know, probably doesn't make sense and we'll curtail. So what you just outlined is exactly what's happened and is why, you know, in the United States, for example, from 2018, 2019, when we first started mining Bitcoin, I mean, when we first started mining Bitcoin, the network hash rate was 125. Mm. I remember the network hash rate was 125. Yeah. Good days. And that was, you know, a couple of halvings ago. So, and, you know, today we're at 630. I mean, that's kind of the, you know, I think that's rolling average. I mean, we're kind of, you know, trending back up. You know, we hit as high as, you know, 650. I think we'll be over 800 by the end of the year. And so we've had 5 or 6 gigs of Bitcoin mining come into the United States in a very relatively short period of time because of that very kind of scenario you outlined. As I look forward now over the next few years, however, now that we're seeing demand growth coming back, and now that utilities are going back to their public utility commissions and saying, hey, we've got demand growth, and therefore we need to build more gas plants, we need to build more transmission lines, we need more, that costs money. And what does the utility do? They say, hey, it costs more money, we need to earn a rate of return. You know, we can argue about what that rate of return is. They settle. And then who does that get passed on to? That gets passed on to everybody. Residential customers, commercial customers, industrial customers. So effectively, the wholesale price of power is going to be impacted by this. And so the question then just becomes, if the demand forecasts that the utilities have made they're overshooting them, right? If the demand actually comes in less than what they have forecast and they have built more for that, there's going to be a period of time where we're going to see higher prices of power. If they've underestimated it and there's more demand, we still may see higher price of power because, you know, the marginal consumer is probably willing to pay a lot more for power. So I actually see a pretty tricky period coming for us over the next 2-3 years. You know, as Bitcoin miners, again, I mean, our number one input is power because now utilities are actually adding a lot to their capital base. You know, they're saying, hey, we need to spend more money. And it's been rare that where the utilities forecast what they need and the actual need come in, you know, in line. You know, there's always a mismatch of some sort. So it's going to be interesting. And that's where I just think we as Bitcoin miners need to be cognizant of the changing kind of dynamics and make sure that how we position ourselves is, again, we're an asset back to this and not just a burden. And what I mean by that is just saying, you know, And you laid it out in a good way, I think, you know, kind of, you know, when you think about economically, there's kind of short-term economics and there's long-term economics. And so for somebody like us, we want to be in business for 50 years. You know, I'm not thinking that, hey, once I amortize my S19, I'll take it off and I'll go, you know, somewhere else in the world. No, we think our facilities are going to be there in mine for a very long period of time. And so, again, we need to be thinking of ourselves as how are we assets back to the grid. And as I said, there's a shift happening in what's been happening over the last 7 to 8 years where I think, again, we're starting to see kind of some of that early, but where I think I see things going over the next couple of years is that there's a meaningful amount of CapEx being injected into the system by utilities. And again, when there's money being spent, someone's got to pay for it. And again, we as Bitcoin miners, don't want to pay more. And again, if we're part of the system, you know, it's going to find its way to us. And so again, we have to be very, I think, kind of thoughtful in how we're positioning ourselves and how we're saying, you know, we're going to be partners or consumers of that kind of growing demand.
Just briefly, over what time period briefly is, or typically is this infrastructure amortized by utilities? What do you know? What
numbers? Long periods, right? I mean, transmission lines are, you know, 20, 30 year assets, okay. Generation assets, or, you know, 15 to 20 year assets. And so those get amortized, you know, over that period of time. And as I said, if you're doing a linear amortization over 15 years, you know, there's probably years where the utilization is lower. And there's probably years where the utilization is higher. And so that's what I was saying earlier. It's rare that the utilities are spot on in meeting, kind of saying where they think things are going to be and where they end up being, right? So that's where that mismatch, right, can kind of create these pockets of, you know, higher or lower prices. And so, so again, that's where it's going to become, I think, even more important over the next year or two. When we look at Bitcoin miners and where are they located, and how, again, are they integrating kind of, you know, where they are back to the grid.
We talked earlier or a lot about economics, talked earlier about reputational risk. You guys are a publicly listed company, and your core focus or what your tagline evolves around is sustainability. How does that factor into what we just spoke about, and why is that so important to you guys?
So as I said earlier, you know, there's a meaningful kind of transition occurring in the supply stack. And so a number of coal assets across the country have retired or are continuing to retire. And the challenge that coal assets have, and so I've kind of put it in kind of a couple of different buckets, you know. So one is just purely from a operational and cost perspective. As the number of coal plants decrease, there's fewer people to make parts for them. There's fewer people to maintain them. There's fewer people to kind of, you know, run operations for them. And so the level of R&D that goes into making, you know, better things more efficiently, cheaper, goes away, right? So the biggest challenge I see for coal plants, again, setting aside kind of environmental concerns for a second, is just as the size of the fleet goes down, and as fewer and fewer people are kind of coming into that because they don't see it as a long-term business, and fewer people are investing into the R&D around making that business more efficient, it just over time kind of costs really start to creep up. And so I think coal plants are seeing that already. And they're, you know, every time something breaks, these are, you know, complicated, you know, pieces of equipment. It becomes longer, more expensive, less people to kind of be able to kind of fix things. So that's, I think, a trend that's kind of gone beyond reversal. So from a coal plant perspective, I think you'll continue to see that decreasing. And then, you know, again, now you layer on top of that environmental concerns with respect to kind of carbon, mercury, and SO2 and different things. And so, and that's not even factoring those costs in. Gas plants, you know, we had a period where I'd say over the past five years, you know, there was kind of a little bit of a lull. Now you're starting to see utilities come back and say, hey, we have pretty significant demands that we need to meet. We're not going to be able to just meet that with wind and solar. We need some base load type generation, and we want to build some more gas plants. And so gas plants, you know, I think we'll probably hit kind of an intermediate trough. And I think over the next couple of years, we'll start to see kind of an uptick in the kilowatt hours of power being consumed from natural gas resources, just given where demand is going. And then the kilowatt hours of power that are coming from wind and solar are going to continue to kind of increase, you know, at a significant growth rate. And so when I think about, again, Bitcoin mining responsiveness, it's those intermittent resources where there's a ton of supply, which also creates the most opportunity. And you think about wind, for example, you know, wind is not, solar is coincident with the peak, right? When it's the hottest part of the day, solar is running, you know, the highest. And so in some sense, solar is a good asset. It's coincident with the peak. Wind oftentimes is not coincident with the peak. You know, wind is probably, you know, usually the strongest at 2 or 3 in the morning when demand happens to be the lowest, which is why, you know, in areas with strong wind generation, you see these negative priced hours, right? Because they're putting power onto the grid at the very time where the demand is actually the lowest. So as I thought about the business, you know, again, when you think about supply and demand, you know, locating loads where you can see this biggest mismatch between kind of where supply exists and demand exists is oftentimes kind of around this. And so there is a tremendous amount of kind of capital, government support, and resources kind of being pushed to, again, decarbonize the grid. And so both economically and environmentally, you know, we see that, you know, positioning our loads in those places where that's happening is the most effective way. And again, you know, where we find ourselves is, you know, we're 25 miles away from a large-scale hydro facility, that 2.5 gigawatts of hydro. We're the very first substation that comes off that high voltage transmission line. Where we sit in the state of New York, there's relatively low demand. All of that power wants to make its way to New York City, which is pretty much as far away from, you know, where we sit as you can kind of get in the state. So again, there's this mismatch. We're at a nuclear plant again. We're at a 2 gigawatt nuclear plant that sits in the middle of Pennsylvania. There's loads in the east of Pennsylvania and the west of Pennsylvania. We sit in the middle. Again, you got to get transmission to kind of move that power out. So again, we're positioning ourselves as where there's an abundance of supply and not as much demand. So, you know, again, there's a significant transition going on in the supply stack. We want to be, again, a part of the solution to that. And again, from an economic perspective, we think in doing so, we're going to generate the lowest cost of power for ourselves. And when I look at where our cost of power has been versus, you know, our peers, you know, every month we tell everybody what our cost of power was for the month. You know, we're, you know, usually, you know, at the lowest, you know, second lowest. I mean, you know, we're usually kind of, you know, pretty far down in terms of the scale where we're at. So again, it's important to us because it's both makes both economic sense. And then I think, you know, from an environmental perspective, you know, we believe, again, some of those non kind of cash factors have a long-term implication. You know, we talked again about kind of short-term economics versus long-term economics. And so again, when we start to kind of think about those things, you know, from a long-term perspective, we think again, having a zero carbon generation base, you know, from a long-term perspective is kind of, you know, a better decision as well.
I said earlier that I think that a no market, a free market or less regulation is important more than ever now. It's nowhere as important as in the energy space. Do you see a shift from a regulatory perspective of an acceptance almost of flexible loads to enable more generation to come online and to be financed? Or do you still think that in the midterm, long-term, regulatory bodies are going to use their judicial power to push more renewables into the market?
I think the regulatory bodies will continue to push renewables. I mean, in the United States, we've had a pretty significant federal bill that, again, is promoting, you know, renewable resources and the transmission to support that. And I think the other thing, I think that will continue. And I don't think it's all just environmental, right? I mean, from a purely geopolitical perspective as well. I think, you know, the more that countries and nations can produce their own energy, the better off they're going to be, right? I mean, if I take a step back and think about why is Bitcoin so fascinating, part of the reason it's so fascinating is that it's kind of, you know, outside of the norm of kind of the government-run systems that we have in place economically. But from an energy perspective, you know, that's a similar theme, right? So if you were reliant on somebody giving you your energy sources, and whether that's coming from the Middle East or from South America or anywhere else, or the US or Russia, whatever you may be, you can start to see why individual countries may say, hey, you know, it's more important for us to kind of generate our own source of energy. And if it's small, you know, let's do it in a bigger way. And so the sun and the wind aren't, you know, that's not local to only a couple countries, right? The sun and the wind exist everywhere. And so if you're a country that, you know, was importing 90% of your fuel, yeah, natural gas may be cheaper, coal may be cheaper, but I still think that country is going to want to build their solar and wind resources because it's a domestic resource and they're not reliant on somebody telling them so at some point in time, hey, we're not going to give it to you. We're only going to give it to you if you meet these conditions. And so it's not purely just an environmental thing. I think there's also a geopolitical component to it that you're seeing, and particularly where the world is today, right? I mean, I think, you know, we're starting to see kind of, I'd say, fences going up rather than fences coming down. And so from power perspective, I believe that we will continue to see a very strong push in the United States and a number of markets, you know, outside the United States to promote domestic, you know, zero carbon resources, because again, no country has a monopoly on the wind and the sun. And so, again, I think that part of it is regulation, but I also do think that, you know, there's some logic to it that's important as well. And therefore, again, a lot of those are intermittent resources. You know, they're there when they're there. They don't run all the time. And it gets back to the earlier point we talked about, which is fundamentally flexible loads are going to be critical, you know, for, you know, kind of where I think that we know the world is going.
Nazar, time is flying by. Originally, we had planned to speak about a lot more things. I want to focus on the AI and the BTC piece still, because I think that's very fascinating. You guys are focused on infrastructure, right? Do you own all of the infrastructure that that you guys are deploying, or do you work with operators? And tell me a little bit about the future between AI and Bitcoin mining in America. Where are you there? How do you see this playing out?
Sure. So again, we are a hands-on group. And so everything, all of our assets, we design, we build, we operate. So, you know, there are facilities, our folks design them, we build them, we operate them. And, you know, I like to tell people that the good and the bad is all on us. So if things are going well, we can kind of say, hey, you know, we made some good decisions. But when issues pop up, they're on us, right? I mean, we made those design decisions. We decided, you know, what equipment to use and what vendor to choose. But in doing so, it's also much easier for us to resolve those issues because we know why we made those decisions. You know, it wasn't some third party making it for us. We made those decisions. So we can kind of go back and say, okay, this is what we thought. Didn't work out this way. And now, you know, what do we do next? So we are, again, our models always, we want to design it. We want to build it. We want to operate. And that's what we've done for Bitcoin mining. We are now entering into the AI space. We're completing a 2.5 megawatt pilot that will be online here, you know, in the next 4 to 6 weeks. We have a number of discussions ongoing with end customers, with, you know, providers of the equipment and everything in between. So, you know, I think, you know, we'll hopefully, you know, kind of, you know, in the balance of the year, fill that up. Again, we've designed the facility. We've selected all of the equipment, the cooling mechanisms. We've embedded a liquid cooling design within it as well. And we've thought about, you know, not just where the GPUs are today, but where we think they're going. And, you know, NVIDIA's, for example, is already laid out where they think the Blackwell 200 is going to be, both in terms of operations, you know, rack density, and heat. And so, again, we're thinking about not just, again, designing something that fits where the GPUs are today, but hopefully, you know, in the next couple iterations as well. From that, our plan is to kind of take that 2.5 megawatt and expand it to a 10 megawatt building. So we're working through the design as we speak on that. We're expecting to complete that design work, you know, roughly around the same time where the 2.5 megawatt facility comes online, and start construction on that later in the summer with a target for year-end completion. And so we are spending a lot of time thinking about what is it that the market will need 12, 18, 24 months out, not where is it today. And the reason I say that is I think, you know, we're seeing a couple of different trends. You know, one is this high density compute load is going to where the power exists, you know, and that's different than what's been happening. You know, if you look at where the data center loads exist today, you know, 80% of it exists in 5 or 6 markets in the United States. And so the data center loads used to just go to those markets, wherever they could find capacity in those markets, that's where they would kind of come in. Given the forecast of the amount of power that's going to be needed, that's no longer feasible. You know, we talked about Northern Virginia earlier. They've already said, hey, you know, we're stopping things for a couple of years. We got to figure things out. So they are recognizing that they're going to have to go to where the power exists. Where the power exists. So again, fundamentally, Bitcoin miners kind of show up where there's a lot of power and it's cheap. So they're coming our way. So that's one theme. And that's happening, but it's also not going to happen overnight. And so I think, you know, a lot of times, you know, people, when I talk to people, they're saying, hey, this is happening. Can you show me how it's happened? And I say, I mean, these things take time. You know, it's not a 1 month decision just to go from Northern Virginia to Southstate New York. It's a process. And for people to really ramp up is a process that could take 18 or 24 months. And so we're still in the early stages of that transition, but it's occurring. So that's one theme is you know, the loads are coming to where the power exists for all the various reasons we just talked about earlier of, you know, scaled, low cost, zero carbon power. You know, it's not everywhere. It only exists in certain pockets. Second is I think the legacy data centers are not the best equipped to meet the needs of where the GPUs are going. The legacy data centers are not designed to run a Blackwell 200. They were designed to run a CPU of whatever kind of vintage or generation that they were built. But, you know, fundamentally, the architecture is different of running kind of, you know, tens of thousands of GPUs at scale. And so
what's the main difference, Nazar, quickly, sorry. What's the main difference between a traditional data center running CPUs and an AI data center?
I mean, the traditional data centers, I mean, people have racks where they, you know, solve for rack densities of, you know, 8 to 10, you know, kilowatts per rack, you know, and we're designing for 70 to 120 kilowatts per rack. Mm-hmm. So there's just a step change function in the power density per rack, and a step change function because of the power density on what the cooling mechanisms are going to look like. You know, my own opinion is that, you know, you're going to have a some sort of a liquid cooling mechanism in place to be able to run GPUs at scale in relatively dense data centers. I mean, if you build a data center that's millions of square feet, could you do it? Yes, but then you have to spend a lot of money building that infrastructure out. If you want to be efficient in the size of the data center you're building, you're going to have some form of liquid cooling. So again, when we build power plants, I mean, you use liquid cooling to cool down a turbine. I mean, so the engineering principles that we're using here are not that different. The applications are different. But again, we are really trying to think about where the market need is going to be 12, 18, 24 months from today in terms of that demand forecast. And so a lot of our work in R&D, I'll call it, is really thinking about that and kind of positioning ourselves within that. And so we've been spending a lot of time with NVIDIA, with, you know, Dell, HPE, you know, and a number of customers to make sure that we're hearing from them what their expectations are, what they want to see, and then kind of circling that back with where our design is, where we think we can build, and obviously, what does it cost? I mean, what are the economics associated with it? So again, the demand's coming to where we are. We think we need to build not what exists today, but where things are going to be a couple years out. And so that's the work that we're doing here in 2024. And the idea is that, you know, we'll kind of figure that all out here in 24, and then in 25, we can kind of really ramp and scale that business. And so, you know, at the end of the year, we're targeted to have about 12 and a half megawatts of data center capacity for AI at the end of 24. And, you know, at the end of 25, and I think we should be at, you know, 100 plus megawatts in that space. And just again, order of magnitude, when we're building our Bitcoin mining facilities, we're spending, you know, somewhere around, you know, $450 to $500 per kilowatt. In terms of our CapEx, and we're probably looking at something that's, you know, 8 to 12x that when we're building this capacity, given, again, the density, the cooling requirements that we need. So it's again, a different construction that will happen. And so that's where we're focused today. And the other piece that's important, and that in the discussions that I have, is I tell all these loads, you're going to have to be more responsive than you are. And if you think about where data centers start, they start with having diesel generator backups in the 3-hour instance that they don't have power at their facility. And when you're a 20 megawatt data center, okay, fine. When you're a 200 or 400 megawatt data center, if you're going to have 400 megawatts of diesel generator backups for the 4, 6, 8, or 12 hours that you don't have power, there's your money that you said, but even more important than that, the regulator is going to say, this is crazy. You're putting 400 megawatts of diesel generators on the site for 12 hours. This makes no sense.
Usage factor also, again, right? It's just a bad economic decision.
Bad economic decision. So the big thing that I'm telling these folks is hey, whatever, lay out to me like how responsive you think your load is. And sometimes they're like, well, what do you mean responsive? We're not, we just need to run. So, okay, that's not acceptable.
20% of the time, yeah.
That's not acceptable. So that's the other thing that I think that these loads are going to have to be, you know, I said earlier, every single load is going to be far more responsive than it is today. And that's for sure for data center loads as well. Are there some data center loads that are critical that need to run 24/7? I'm sure there are. 90% plus of the data center loads probably don't need to run 24/7. And so, again, these loads are going to have to figure out how they can become more responsive, because if they're not responsive, it's not a question of money. Microsoft has a lot of money. Google has a lot of money. It's not a question of money. It's a question of just availability. They're not going to be allowed to locate in scale in places if they just say, hey, we need 400 megawatts of power and we don't want to curtail ever.
No, the supplier will not supply them, right? So
yeah. So those are the themes that we're playing. And that's where I think, you know, it's we see a significant opportunity. And again, things are, I think, you know, shifting and migrating more towards what a Bitcoin mining load looks like. Will they be as responsive as a Bitcoin mining load? Probably not, but they're going to have to be more responsive than they are today in terms of how they kind of think
but
about
it. But just to make this clear, Nizar, just briefly, because we're running out of time, all of these loads could dedicate 10% of their contracted load to Bitcoin mining and ramp that up and down, right?
Absolutely. And so that's a great point. I think over time, when you marry these loads together, it's actually going to be far more beneficial for these data center loads. And just for example, if you've got 500 megawatts of data center load only sitting in a node, they need to curtail. It's got to come out of their load. If you have, you know, 200 megawatts of Bitcoin mining load or 150 megawatts of Bitcoin mining load and 350 megawatts of data center load, now you have this 150 megawatt buffer of Bitcoin mining that can say, hey, we'll come down in 15 seconds. And then there is more of a cushion and buffer for them. So I agree.
And you know
so
what? If I was an AI operator, right, I would tell them, look, to be more socially accepted, I would just say, look, I'll balance the grid for free. I'll turn off. Don't even give me money for it.
And just mine Bitcoin.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't think you need to be that generous, but yeah, you could definitely do that. But again, the point that you're making is a good one, which is hey, they will have to think about these issues, because if they don't think about these issues, they will just be told, hey, we don't have the power for you.
Hmm. Yeah, no supply. Nizar, it's been an absolute pleasure. I always ask my guests, and we have to do that. I don't really care how long we've been recording. Do you think that Bitcoin uses enough electricity or not?
Do I think Bitcoin uses enough electricity?
Yep.
I think if my comments kind of have, I think the framing of that question doesn't make sense to me.
Okay, fair enough.
Because again, it's the system. It's all about system utilization, right? So if it's not the absolute quantum of energy that Bitcoin uses, it's how that energy is being used in the context of the overall grid. And so if the total grid in the world was 1 megawatt and Bitcoin was using, you know, half of it, yeah, I would say, yeah, maybe Bitcoin is using too much of it. So in the absolute quantum of how the world operates, Bitcoin doesn't really use that much electricity in the grand scheme of things. But furthermore, and more importantly, the times when Bitcoin uses the electricity is by definition the most opportune times to consume more power, and which should be driving down the cost of power. So again, not to be difficult or anything, but I think just the framing of the question doesn't kind of make sense to me. It's again, it's more how are you using the power? And that's kind of the way I really think about things.
Perfect. The question achieved its goal. I would like to have you guys back, maybe after you concluded your pilot, to talk about what the plans were, what you guys assumed, what went not according to plan, what did, and maybe follow this topic a bit more about, you know, the intersection between AI and Bitcoin. Because even our pre-talk, and we haven't covered this, I said to you, like, if you guys are so much about infrastructure, why isn't it just as exciting to go where Bitcoin will be pushed? So that's the grid of the energy, the edge of the energy systems, right? And you actually said, well, I think that AI will bring on more Bitcoin mining, because there's an ever greater need for that flexibility. So I'd like to further that topic sometime. But for now, I really value that you have given me so much of your valuable time. Do you want to tell folks where they can find more about TerraWolf if they want to inform themselves?
Sure. Well, first, you know, thank you so much for having me on and giving us the chance to kind of give more of, you know, kind of the background in TerraWolf and how we think about, you know, what it is that we do. So again, thank you so much. And, you know, for all the listeners out there, you know, thanks for listening this far into the show. You know, our site, you know, TerraWolf.com has a great deal of information on the company, where we're at. Our investor presentation has you know, pretty detailed breakdown of where we're at, where we're going. On social media, on Instagram, Twitter, you know, we are constantly posting things. And so there's updates happening as updates are happening in the company, we, you know, Chloe helps run our social media team, and Chloe's amazing. So you'll find a lot of information on social as well with respect to kind of the, you know, the week to week and month to month activities that we have going. So please, you know, follow us there. Again, you know, Jesse, thank you so much for having us. It's been a pleasure. And yeah, we'd love to come back. And, you know, the fun part about the space in general, right, is I think, you know, we have the opportunity to really kind of forge a new path. You know, if you think about institutional Bitcoin mining, it didn't really exist 5 years ago. That wasn't a business that existed. And so the things that we're doing today, things that we did yesterday, a year ago, help kind of form what is kind of an accepted path. And so it's not just TerraWulf, but, you know, I mean, all of our peers, you know, we're all kind of in that game together. And so a lot of times, you know, we have a good deal of camaraderie with them as well, because a lot of the issues that they're dealing with, we're dealing with, and it's fun to kind of, you know, trade approaches and thoughts. And so you see, you know, I think, you know, the Bitcoin mining space is unique in that, because again, we're all kind of in this together, figuring things out. And, you know, by definition, we're competitors because there's, you know, kind of a fixed amount of Bitcoin that gets issued. But in reality, I think, you know, there's a lot that we learn from each other. So, so that's, you know, fun. But now, again, we're seeing this, I think, this more significant intersection of energy, data, and the real world. And so that existed before. I mean, I'm not saying it didn't exist before. It definitely existed before. But given the way, you know, kind of with the AI hype that's happening, you're seeing it far more pronounced. And so, again, I think, you know, we as Bitcoin miners are going to have an interesting voice and role to play that I'm really excited about.
You've made my job very easy today. As my hour flew by, I am sure it did for the listeners as well. Guys, if you learned something new, which I'm sure you did, you know what to do. I'll see you next Sunday. This was Hash Right Up. Thank you, Nazar. Bye-bye.